Welcome to Shoot Like a Girl, a podcast featuring interviews with extraordinary military women from around the world who push their limits on and off duty. I'm your host, Kate Stewart, and this is episode number 24. Today's guest is Major Melissa Marshall. Melissa is an artillery officer in the Canadian Armed Forces. She joined after completing university in 2007. She deployed to Afghanistan in 2013 and has served in various roles, including battery commander. She's also completed several athletic endeavors, such as the Bataan Memorial Death March, the Marine Corps Marathon, and five Army Run Half Marathons.
Steady, nice and steady. Light, hill, cover. I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
So you better get out of my way now.
So you better get out of my way now.
Before I roll all over you.
Before I roll all over you.
Melissa, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here. I know we had some technical difficulties, but it worked out at the very last minute.
Yeah, now we're good to go.
Okay, awesome. So where did you grow up?
So I grew up in a very small town on the east side of Nova Scotia called Westville, Nova Scotia. I was originally born in Cape Breton. And then when I was about three, my parents moved to Westville.
Okay, and what was your childhood like? What sort of activities were you involved in?
So I grew up through Army cadets, also grew up through police cadets, and then I've been playing slow pitch slash fast pitch since I was about four. So grew up playing both competitive slow pitch through high school and then through the summer leagues as well. Sorry, and I was also grew up riding horses too.
And so did you have any military members in your family or police members?
Yeah. So my parents actually met when they were in the militia together. My dad was an infantry and my mom was a supply tech, both reservists located in Aldershot. So and then I have a lot of aunts and uncles who either served or are still currently serving or now retired. So, I knew I was either going to go in the Army or be a teacher. And then my dad got really sick my last year of university and almost passed away twice. And it just really makes you realize how short your life is. And then that was like the decision for me that I wanted to go into the Army.
Mm-hmm. So when you were younger, going into cadets, was that something that that needed to be sort of forced on you, or were you excited to do that?
No, that was pretty much like I wanted to do it. I have an older sister, but I was pretty much like the boy my dad never had. And then my sister is very much the very like prim and proper female of the family, we'll say. So I like certainly like grew up more like I really wanted to get involved in Army cadets and have an initial exposure through the cadet side of things and just see if I would like to pursue things further from there.
Okay. And did you have in mind what trade you wanted to do in the military when you were younger?
So not at the time. One of my mom's brothers was a chief warrant officer in the combat engineers, and he said, whatever you do, don't go combat arms. You will not like your life. And it's a very different breed, they say. And then I went to sign up during my last year of university in 2007. So the big push was on for combat arms officers because of Afghanistan. And they said, you have three options. You can be infantry, artillery, or armored. And I knew I could do the infantry physically, but didn't necessarily know if I wanted to be kind of like physically broken at an early age. The armor didn't really interest me. And then I took about 30 seconds to read what the artillery did and then signed a 9-year contract after that.
And so where did you go for university?
So I did my university at St. Thomas University in Fredericton, New Brunswick. I have an honors degree in political science, a specialty in international relations.
Okay. Yeah, I'm from the East Coast as well, so I know all of these places. I have a lot of family in Antigonish, so we drive by Westville and that whole area all the time.
Oh, neat. Small world.
Yeah. So when you went off to basic training or BMOQ, I guess, was it a culture shock for you or was it just you were used to that already from being in cadets?
So I was used to like the dress and the drill. We had a very hard basic. We started with 62 and ended with 21. obviously the military was a bit different about 15 years ago. So it seemed as if at that time, they kind of did whatever they could to weed out the weak ones. I remember going through some things of some endeavors while saying basic training. I'm like, oh my God, is this worth it? And kind of just resonate, like everything has an end time frame. Like this eventually will come to an end. And I knew I just had to make it past basic and I could pretty much just carry on through there. But I knew it was supposed to be challenging. I didn't realize it was going to be that challenging. And they certainly made things interesting throughout the training.
Yeah, that number seems crazy for that, because you would have been going through with Navy and Air Force members as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you just seen as, I think at that point in time, the basic military officer qualification was about 20 weeks. So we started to see as the weeks went on throughout the conduct of the course, just people just started to peel off the course. They're like, no, I'm not doing this. Like, this isn't worth it anymore. And I really knew I wanted to be in the Army, and I just knew that this was a challenging period. As part of the initial training, I'm like, I can make it through here. So.
And what did you find the most challenging about that course?
It was like, I was always like in shape throughout high school. But they definitely like pushed limits, like from like a PT perspective that I wasn't used to at that time. So I had to like learn how to, I've thought of in good shape. Well, you're going to need to get in better shape in order to be able to keep up. I think a lot of it was like the mental aspect of it. Like at that point in time, I didn't know what mental resiliency was or how to either foster or develop it. So a lot of it was like, this is really hard right now. Can I make it past this without seeing like the bigger pictures? So there was a lot of mind games, I would say, that was played at that time. The Army was a different place, we'll say, back then. And, you know, we've since grown and matured in a lot of ways. And maybe some of the things we went through wasn't necessarily the most conducive to training or positive working environment, but I look back now and it honestly made me better in the end, like experiencing those hardships that we did, because it was also a learning experience. Because I knew at that point in time, like, you know, when I am becoming an officer, like I would never treat some people or like some soldiers or officers the way that we were treated. But that's what I kind of take away from like hard experiences. Like it's a learning experience as to either what you're going to do in the future or what you will choose not to do in the future as a result of that.
Yeah, there are definitely some good examples that I can think of too when I was going through, and it was just like how not to be a leader, because you see what happens and it doesn't serve any purpose, right? It's just wearing people down, and it's not, you're not the kind of person that people want to follow because they want to follow. They're just doing it because, you know, they're brand new and they have to do what you say. So how many other women were on that course with you?
There's three other females. One passed away due to a drug overdose in 2013. One has fully just released last month, and then one has a component transferred to the reserves.
Okay. And then were there, I guess, probably others that didn't make it all the way through?
No, it was just us four beginning. So I kind of... I was the only female combat arms officer too, so you kind of have a different light painted on you. And, you know, sometimes I think based upon the trade that you were at that time, they were either going to drive you harder as a result of that to see, you know, if you're going to be in our trade, then you better be able to like measure up to our trade type of mentality. So
did you find that being the only women on the course, you sort of had that extra pressure, like, well, I better not quit because I'm sort of, you know, all eyes are on me and there's probably people out there that don't want to see us succeed?
Yeah. And you've seen it in the difference that there was at the firm, like PT standards, because at that time it was a CF Express test and there was like the male standard and then there was the female standard. So there's almost like an expectation that less was kind of expected of you from like either a physical fitness or like even a shooting capability, just because you were female. And like, I think we've just like the Marines do, like Kyle, I'm sure has told you, like the Marines have one standard. And I think we should always have just been one standard from the infancy stages. So,
yeah, that's one thing that I didn't agree with as well on the express test. And I mean, the numbers were so low, even I think if you were the maximum number of push-ups women would have to do would be 9, and then as you get older I think it even went down to something like 4. To me it's like, you're in the military, you should be able to do way more than that, you know, regardless of your age. But that is always another thing that, you know, the men kind of use that as something against us to say, well, they don't have to meet the same standard.
Yeah.
And then so after you finish that course, where do you go from there?
So it was very quick. So I finished basic December 2007. And then I started what was called Common Army Phase at that time with the infantry school in February. Prior to the conduct of Common Army Phase, we did a week of winter warfare with the infantry school. And I just remember like my knees feeling like jelly because it's such like a hard winter. And the amount of times where you're told to like pull throughout the night, like, you know, from your like sleeping bag to like tearing down the tent to like packing up your group and then to move into a different area. And I just remember it was like you just dropped your knees so much. And I just remember my knees being like incredibly sore at the end of the week, because probably like maybe, you know, 25 to 50 times during the week you're in and out of your tent, whether it's because you're going out to do some sort of activity or you're tearing the tent down, etc. And then we started CAP the following week, and I remember it was just like, it was like almost a repeat of the basic course, it seemed like, because at the same time there was an all infantry CAP running at the same time. And my friends that were on there, they're like, what is going on with your course? Like, we're not nearly getting driven as hard as you guys were. So there was days on CAP where we would do like what's called range week. So we would ruck out to the range probably like 5 to 7 kilometers after we did like a 10 kilometer run that morning. I just remember like going down the stairs at the end of the week and just having like pain in your knees from like just like so much like impact throughout. And but like, you know, a lot of what your experience on courses is based upon like the staff that are associated with the course. And that doesn't mean that it's necessarily a bad thing, just your course is sometimes more challenging than a course that could be running at the same time as yours. And that's strictly from like a personality perspective. Like, you know, a lot of those soldiers had just come back from Afghanistan or were still rotating through. So, you know, if they were going to train the next generation of officers, then in my mind, you should be trained hard, because you're always supposed to train for, you know, not like the current war, but like the war that is coming or the war that you'll be going to, should always be ready to go to conflict. And I think that was like still really fresh in their mind. It was like, you're going to get it and you're going to get trained as hard as possible. And I think, you know, you look back at it and you're like, oh, some things that you went through, they were like terrible, whether it was like a super hard run or super hard ruck. But I think honestly, in the long term, it makes you better in the end for it, because you were trained hard. And then you in turn want to like train your soldiers hard so they're fit too. You just have to find that fine balance between like, there's a difference between training people so that they really take away like, hey, that was a great hard PT session. Then there's a difference between like running people into the ground. Like that old mentality of you have to break down people physically in order to build them back up again, like that doesn't exist anymore, and maybe it shouldn't have ever existed. There's a difference between like training hard for a purpose and then training hard where people like just legitimately end up being hurt.
Yeah, exactly. And so you had mentioned earlier a little bit about, you know, mental resilience. So during those courses where you were going through those hard times, did you ever experience times where you thought like, maybe this isn't for me, or how did you get past that?
You know, as you start to like mature, I was fresh out of university, not even a year out of university. So I was used to like, and I went to civilian university, vice ROTP. So you kind of like, oh, if I'm not going to class, like it's not a big deal, where it's not the same as if you're at RMC. So I think I started to think of things in like, not necessarily like, hey, we're going out to the field Monday, you know, I just got to make it to Friday. Started to take it in like smaller gaps, like, oh, now we're done, you know, our lunch ration, and like, oh, now we're done our supper ration, and vice like, oh, I have 5 nights to go in that, you know, cold in the field. Now I have 1 night to go. So kind of just take it in different strides. And I definitely learned how to like, how is that as you went on through your career and like experienced harder exercises or harder training or, you know, incurred like physical injuries and that, and how to like make it past that. Cause I think a part of like the military is like, you do really get injured sometimes. And either you can have like an active recovery and make yourself better for it, or you can have a passive recovery where you just kind of sit at home and like the woe is me mentality, but it's not going to make your mind stronger, and certainly not going to make your body stronger either. So.
Yeah, I think that is such a huge thing, because when you're on, you mentioned one of those courses was 20 weeks. And if you're having a hard time in week two and you think, oh, well, I've got 18 weeks of this left, that's going to be a lot harder mentally than just making it past the next task or just to the next meal. And if you just break it down, it makes it so much more manageable.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like easy, like short-term goals, by trying to like see the end as soon as like it starts. It's just I think you just kind of drive yourself a bit crazy if you're just planning to get out as soon as you're out there, right? So.
Mm-hmm. And that you mentioned it was CAP, so that was Common Army Phase for officers. So that would be logistics officers and all sorts of other, not necessarily just combat arms trades, right?
Yeah. So like on my CAP, I had logistics officers. I had a few Air Force. I had a MARS officer too. So he had a hard time because he's like, I'm never going to use any of this in my life. Like I'm going to go on a ship or submarine as soon as I'm done this. And so sometimes you use other people's like examples thereof, or you're like, you know, sometimes they're like, hey, I don't know why I'm doing this. I'm never going to use this again. And, you know, maybe that's your opportunity, not your opportunity, but maybe that's like a good time for you to like really help them make it through, because you can see that they're struggling, especially like, I'm never going to use this again. And I found the same thing happened. Like I remember being in grade 9 and learning trigonometry, like A plus B equals C on a chalkboard. I was like, I don't know why we're learning this. I'm never going to use this again. And then the first day of phase 3 for artillery was the theory of interior opposite angles. And I was like, there it is. There it is. It's come full like 360. It's come back to haunt me. And there it is. Now it's going to be my life. So,
yeah, I think it's funny too, with like back in the day before the cell phones, and the teachers would always say like, oh, you're not going to always have a calculator. And now look at us, we have these cell phones. So I think I have definitely become way too reliant on that. And I probably wouldn't know how to do simple math in my head or on paper now if I had to. So what happens after CAP? Then you get posted to a base?
So after CAP, then we did what's called phase 3 artillery, or development phase 1.2. So again, there was only about 3 weeks in between a finished CAP. And then I was told I was going to Shiloh to do development phase 1.1. Commonly referred to as phase 3 artillery. So we come out and the course itself was being facilitated by the 1st Regiment Royal Canadian Horse Artillery, which is the Reg Force gun regiment that's stationed out here in Shiloh. And during phase 3 artillery is when you they change the courses quite a bit, like for the training plan. But at that time, we learned how to be like a recce officer. We learned how to recce, select, and occupy a gun position. We were actually trained on the old C-103s or 105 Mike howitzers. And there's, I think there's an inherent value to learning all the positions on a gun, because officers don't learn that nowadays. And when you get up into like your forward observation officer training, you have a better appreciation when you're up in the observation post. You're like, why is it taking so long for the guns to respond? And the fact that you were qualified on those positions, you have a better understanding as like, you know, it's foggy, it's rainy. They're having a hard time like identifying certain instruments, which helps with the fixation or orientation of the guns. So I think that was very value added and very positive. And because as you get up in the observation posts, like I said, in the OPs we call it, you have a better appreciation for, you know, what is taking so long with the guns, or maybe why there might be a delay.
And so why do they not teach that anymore?
I haven't actually asked that question. It could very well be like, the artillery transition to the 155 M777 howitzers. An M777 howitzer by book is a 10-person gun detachment. So there's so many like newly qualified gunners coming through the trade itself that I understand the rationale for having to, you know, give the priority to them in order to be qualified on the gun, because that's their bread and butter and that's what they do every day. They've also like revamped the development phase 1.1 and 1.2 for artillery officers. So, you know, sometimes you start with a course of 20 and maybe only graduate 10, because from a technical perspective, it can be very challenging so far. So I think they've had to revamp the courses, spend more time on this, vice time on this, or put this one in the last part of the phase training vice at the beginning, because maybe there's too high of a failure rate. So
interesting. And so you mentioned the forward observation officer, which is something I've heard of before, but I don't quite know what their main role is. Could you explain that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So artillery officers and as well as artillery NCOs are trained as forward observation officers. So that would be like you're up front where the battle is. You would be co-located with a supported arms commander. That could be either an infantry commander or an armored commander. And basically you're providing indirect fire advice to the supported arms commander. I was a FOO for both 2RCR, 2nd Battalion, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, the Lord Strathcona's Tank Regiment, 1st Battalion, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. And so basically you're up front. The M777 with extended range can fire up to 42 kilometers. So you're up front with support arms commander where the battle is occurring, and you're providing fire's advice to them. So he'll provide you with his overall scheme of maneuver when they're going to go on a combat team attack. He'll identify that, you know, we're going to hit this first. So perhaps before they cross what's called the line of departure, you as a forward observation officer, you're directly tied into the gun net. So I'd be talking to the guns back at their location because they're not up front with the battle, they're back. And I would be basically developing what's called a fire plan in support of this attack. And I would soften up the targets or neutralize the targets as this combat team is progressing down through the attack. And there are certain times where, you know, you have to provide like the support arms commander, especially when you go into elements like a mission that's called danger close. So danger close by definition is anything within 600 meters of friendly troops. So as you can imagine, the guns deployed in Afghanistan, like pretty much almost every fire mission was almost a danger close capacity. So as you start to bring the rounds in closer, like 600 meters, 500 meters, 400 meters, you're constantly advising the supported arms commander on potential hazards that could occur, like fratricide, because things that are brought into consideration, you know, are the troops mounted in labs? No. Okay. Are they dismounted? Okay. Do they have overhead protection? So there's multiple things we have to deal with when we're calculating the trajectory of the round or where the round is going to land. There's things what's called PER or probable error in range, meaning the gun could fire long or fire a bit short. Or there's another thing called probable error in deflection, which means, you know, from their trajectory outwards, they could fire left a little bit or they could fire right a little bit or, you know, east or west a little bit more than they are. What had originally forecasted. So you have to be really on board with your drills and really know how to talk to that supported arms commander and provide them that technical advice, because they're not going to know it. So they're looking at you to provide, like, I can provide suppressing fire on this target for you for this period of time with this type of ammunition, which then will logically yield this type of effect. And then, you know, not every attack goes perfect. Sometimes, like, they can have a call sign that's held up. So then you have to switch fires maybe into a different target. And then you can also identify to the SAC, they call them, if there's any issues in terms of, like, you know, we only have so much of this type of ammunition or so much of this type of ammunition, we're going to hit this target with this type of ammunition because it'll have more of an effect. So being a FOO, I always say was probably like one of the best opportunities in my career, because every supported arms commander is different, right? Like, I was a FOO for now retired Lieutenant General Cadu when he was the CO of the Strathconas. And then, a Strathcona supported arms commander operates differently than like a 2RCR, than a 2VP. So, sometimes they like to keep you like right beside them, right close. Other times what's best for us is we kind of go off on our own in order to adopt like the best position of observation where we can visually see the rounds impacting the target and adjust them accordingly. Cause we're all like, we always have a radio attached to us. So I'm always going to be on, I'll have a fires net, which is me talking directly to the gun. And then I'll have what's called a combat team ed on the other side. So I'm always hearing all the orders or any adjustments that might have to occur when you're going on a combat team attack. So yes, that was probably like one of the best opportunities in my career. So
super interesting. So, and again, like I said before, I know pretty much nothing about the artillery. So are the guns inside of a FOB or do you put them, are they located outside of a FOB somewhere and positioned?
I guess it would all depend. In the earlier years of Afghanistan, like sometimes they were located in a FOB, and realistically that's the best. It depends on like the threat at the time and the threat risk scenario. Sometimes it's the best for them to be located in a FOB, right? Because if you start to lose some of your firepower, especially what we had in Afghanistan, then that could be detrimental to those troops who are dismounted and getting in some sort of a tick right now. But not necessarily, they don't necessarily all have to always be in a FOB. obviously for training, we don't train at a FOBS here in Shiloh. Like our whole impact, our whole range training area is an impact area. So we can deploy the guns in any capacity in order to conduct training there. So it would honestly just depend upon the environment that you're deployed in.
Okay. And then how are they moved around? Is that with a helicopter, a big truck, or either or?
So you can certainly do a helo or a helicopter operation. You can airlift an M777. We have what's called a military standard pattern vehicle, SMP, which is essentially a large Mack truck that came into operation basically the end of 2018, but really it became the primary mover for the guns 2019. So basically it hooks up to the front of the gun will have what's called a trunnion on it. It looks like a big ring, and the ring hooks up to the back of the truck, which then also acts as the primary mover for the transport for the soldiers. So the gun detachment hooks the gun up, and then they hop up in the back of the truck, and then the gun and all the gunners move that way.
Okay, interesting. All these artillery questions from a Navy person. and so after you get initially qualified, what's your first posting as a new artillery officer?
So my first posting, I was posted to the Royal Regiment of Canadian Artillery School. So that's located in Gagetown as part of the Combat Training Center. So I did about 2 years there. And then in 2011 is my first time I was posted to the 1st Regiment Royal Canadian Horse Artillery in Shiloh, Manitoba. So I did some time as a forward observation officer. And then I deployed with Op Attention Roto 3 because 1RCHA was the lead mounting unit for Task Force 213. So I deployed, our CO at the time is the deputy commander for the task force, and I deployed as the National Command Support Element Task Force Adjutant at the time. So I was stationed out of Camp Phoenix, Kabul, and that was the NATO headquarters for Kabul. Basically working under the J1, who's the lead for all administration. So I would facilitate the administration for 11 outstation camps that we had, and then in addition to Camp Phoenix. So that's everything from miscellaneous loss, basically anything that would have to go to a unit CO in a unit in Canada would be the same type of administration that would have to go to a deployed CO of the NCSE. So it was really interesting. So about 6,000 soldiers stationed on Camp Phoenix. And it was really interesting getting to work with like the Americans, the Georgians. Georgia at the time was trying to earn a spot into NATO. So they weren't actually, they didn't speak a lot of English. So they just mostly did like gate duty and guard tower, but try to like talk with them in the DFAC sometime just to like learn from other people in other countries. But there wasn't a whole lot of feedback going on there. So largely just administration, but I did get to make it out to about almost all the camps, less one. So really had a great opportunity, and being deployed to Kabul like that, that was a life changing experience for me. And I'll never forget that. Just things like having stop signs or like traffic lights, like they don't exist there. I remember we got stuck in downtown traffic. It was like traffic is so congested all the time. And we were in upper armored SUVs at the time, and you ride with your, you have a pistol strapped, and then you have your C7 and your barrels down, and our vehicle got swarmed. And I just remember like your doors are always locked, but like someone trying to like open the door, and you just kind of like raise up your long barrel a little bit, and then they just like back away. And but never did I think like growing up in a little town of 5,000 people would I ever find myself in like a situation like that. And I remember getting back, and you just eat at the dining facility there that's run by the Americans. And my first week getting back, I remember like buying groceries and being overwhelmed by the amount of selections for mustard. Like I'll never forget that. Like just like no name brand, like honey mustard, Dijon mustard, like you name a type of mustard, and just the things that like your mind's like, I have a hard time dealing with this, and it's really not a big deal. And then you just kind of learn to like adapt and like, you know, transition back into your normal life there. So yeah, that was quite interesting. It was really rewarding to be part of the last Canadian contingent Kabul. So we were able to do like the last Remembrance Day parade. We were also invited to the last September 11th parade that the Americans hosted. So that was quite an honor to be a part of that as well.
Do you have any particularly like memorable moments? What was sort of the best part of that deployment for you?
Something that really stood out to me was that the first Friday in every month, the female Afghan market would come on to Camp Phoenix. So we always had, there was always like established shops that the males always ran. And then the first Friday of every month was just dedicated to the female market. And they would come and like set up their little shops or little areas on top of the parade square. And I always knew when they were coming. So I'd always like wait if I wanted to buy a new scarf or tablecloth for one of my family members. And so I would always like, they don't want you to take any food at the DFAC, but I would always take like a couple popsicles and like, you know, a couple apples. And this master sergeant used to always like eyeball me. And then one time we just headed out and he was just like, I've asked you before, Captain, like not to take popsicles out. And I'm like, okay, so I'm taking this popsicle and like these five apples. And that's it. Like for the amount of money that the Americans like spent on food, it was astronomical. And I just remember, like, I would always go to this same older lady to buy, like, my scarves and my tablecloths for my family. And I gave her daughter a popsicle one day. And the mother cried. And I told the daughter, because the daughter would translate, I'm like, oh, I didn't mean to upset her or offend her. And she's like, no, she just thought that was very nice of you to do, because she's like, I've never had a popsicle in my life. And she was probably, like, 16 years old. And you know, you never realize like how good your life is, like something so little of that. It's like having a popsicle on a 35 degree temperature day. And you never think, we wouldn't think twice about it. We would just drive down to the store like, oh, I'm going to go buy a popsicle, but never have like a treat or something like that in your life. It makes you kind of like drive things home. You're like, you know, we've really got it good here. And I often like, because I have a picture with her and her younger sister, and I share it every year on Facebook whenever it comes, pops up as the memories. And I often like, you kind of wonder, like, I wonder what happened to them, especially like what happened to Kapoor in September of 2021. So, it was really like, I think probably the most rewarding experience from Kapoor was that you really, if you didn't appreciate your life before, and not necessarily not appreciate, but it really made you like open your eyes, you know, to how good we actually have it in our everyday lives, and what we actually take for granted is what someone else would like love to live for. So,
yeah, like you said, just going back and just realizing like this mustard selection that we have, all of these things that you don't think about until you sort of go to the other side of the world and see how other people live and what they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Working with other countries, what was their attitude towards women? Did you have any issues or how did that go?
I think we were always like, you know, instructed before we left for Afghanistan, like, you know, the local culture of the Afghans, those working on the camp, like they're always going to want to like hug you and embrace you because that's like what they do in their culture. But we were always advised like, hey, don't do that, especially because you're like carrying a weapon, right? So you're like, you never know what could happen. And, I remember just like working with the Afghans, like working with the Georgians, like you tried to like just make a conversation in the like the dining facility, and they were just like kind of like, for seeing like blonde hair, blue eyed females, like was something they'd never seen before. And you're like, okay, have a good day, bye. And the Americans were really good to work with. I emceed part of their September 11th last parade that they had in Kabul, so that was quite an honor for me. And then as part of being the task force sage, like I had to tie into like their respective other administrative officers, or XOs they call them for the Americans, and they were always really good. Like we never had any issues with the camp. Like it was probably a multi-million dollar camp that the Americans had set up. So working with the Americans, the French, like everybody was always positive. We shared some of our rooms in the shacks with some of the Aussies, and they were always very polite. And I couldn't believe the amount of stuff that like American companies sent over for females, like Mary Kay and all those cosmetics line. And the girls would just like, there's this like communal bench in the bathroom, and the girls would just like throw all this stuff, like just throw it there. And they're like, yeah, if anyone wants this, because I don't want it. And you're like, hey, like a toothbrush or like a wrapped up bar of soap. Like I would put everything like that in like a pillowcase, and then I would hand it out at the, when the female market came in. Cause like, imagine never having a bar of like Dove soap in your life and you don't have anything to like wash with. So I was like, oh, I'm going to like Santa this up. And like, I would just throw everything in a, in a pillowcase, and I would just, like, you know, for the kids or whatever, for the older ladies, I was like, you pick whatever you want out and I'll see you next month. So
yeah, I've heard about that too, like people trading, Canadians trading stuff for Oakleys for the Americans because they had so many pairs. And that's just, yeah, it's kind of interesting to see, I guess, or hear about like what gets sent over or what they have a ton of. And so after you got back from that deployment, then what's sort of next on the career list for you?
So then I was posted to Kingston. I was posted to Canadian Army Simulation Centers. So the sim centers where Italian personnel, also military personnel, put on simulation exercises in support of things like the Army Operations course, you know, some Air Force courses as well, so they can simulate their respective either brigade level plans or battle group plans. So I was posted to there because for the military, so the military can't actually like task a Italian operator, so that's why you need a person in green, what's called a military assistant, in order to facilitate that working relationship through and help set up the exercises from a support perspective. So I did that for 2 years, and then I was asked if I would go to Edmonton to be the like deputy G5 of the brigade. So you have a G5 of a brigade who's the lead planner, and then I was his G5 too, so you're his second. I was only in there for a year, but we actually went on a large scale exercise with a unit called the 25th Infantry Division, which is based out of Hawaii. And so we were on Warfighter 17.4, and Warfighter 17.4 was a month long level 10 CACs, which was stationed out of Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Seattle, Washington. So the 25th Infantry Division, they were the next division to go in the hopper for South Korea. So if they weren't successful on this exercise, then they weren't going to go. So spending a month in Seattle in a command post, just facilitating this, being a part of this level 10 exercise. You're also hooked into like another element in Texas. You're hooked into like three other elements in Hawaii. And then I think we were hooked into like another element in Virginia. So it was like a multi like US state level exercise. And, you know, Canada runs, we have our computer assisted exercises, but I'd never been a part of anything like that before. So that was quite a rewarding experience for that, just to see like the highest like divisional level planning and support of manufactured attacks, we'll say. So just seeing like the multinational coordination and how we would facilitate things in terms of like resupply and that, it was really rewarding from like a planning perspective. And then we also had about 30 what's called observer controller trainers. So you're part of what's called the primary training audience. And then the Americans also put in your command posts someone that would like, okay, like, what are you doing right now? Like, when's your next set of orders going to come out? And like, why did this service and support happen like this? So you're part of an exercise, but then you're also being like mentored throughout it. Because you're part of like what's called like the secondary training audience, where the 25th Infantry Division was the primary training audience. So really got to work with like a lot of great Americans there and like really hone their experience, because the Americans deploy all the time, right? So really like got to learn a lot from them. And that was another great like exercise to be part of.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how the Americans do stuff just with the, you know, with the amount that they spend on their military and the sheer huge numbers that they have. I remember doing a dive exercise in Cape Breton, and their salvage divers came up. I mean, they just showed up with tons of equipment that we don't even have to sort of patch and float this boat that was half sunk, and then pull it into shore with these giant cables. And it was just insane that the dive command post that they set up there within like a day. But it was just, the equipment that they have is insane.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was on an exercise in Blackstone, Virginia in 2009 as an artillery safety officer. So in Canada, artillery can't fire without having a safety officer verify that the data for which where the round is going to land is verified safe, either in an impact area or a ricochet area. So I got deployed down with a reserve brigade, and just the amount of like, you would drive through this base and they would just have like 100 paladins, some mobile artillery just under tarp. They're like, yeah, those are just our spares, and that's from a reserve unit. Like, there's no reserve unit in Canada that has 100 artillery guns under tarp right now. So just seeing the amount of like kit and equipment that they have. And that was, unfortunately, that was my first time and only time I've ever seen like a 30 gun illumination mission. So each illumination round is the equivalent to like 500,000 candles. So if you can imagine 30 like 105 guns firing those rounds at the same time into the air and making some sort of formation with the illumination rounds, it was quite interesting to see. It's just that Canada unfortunately doesn't have that. We just don't have that amount of kit and equipment available right now. So,
and so that exercise in Seattle, did they end up passing that and going on to South Korea?
Yeah, so they ended up passing it. So it was really interesting because so we weren't qualified on the Americans' computer equipment, so we weren't allowed to like actually use it. So their equipment's called a CPOF, and then you know you have like a phone here beside you, but we're not qualified on it, so we're not actually allowed to use it. So you would have like, you're sitting there at the computer, and then you have like a private, an American private, and you're like, hello, can you like slick, like click through this slideshow for me? And he's like, yes ma'am, no problem. Or like I would literally have to go like, good morning, can you dial like extension like 356, like literally standing there above the phone, like, can you dial extension 3561 for me? And they're like, yes ma'am, no problem. Do-do-do. And then they like hand you the phone and you're like, you just like, I always felt bad because I'm like, I never want anyone to like ever feel like I am not above you, and I never feel like I should be treated as if I'm above you. And if I had it my way, I would just simply pick up the phone myself and dial, or like scroll through my own PowerPoint. And but just because we didn't have interoperability with them, we weren't qualified on their and it's just like a normal computer system, it's just the version that the Americans use. So really interesting like learning that and just seeing that you're like, please don't take this, you know, if I'm allowed to dial my own extension, I would dial my own extension and not like, hello private logins, can you dial 3561 for me? And so it's like you take away like good times from it. But the Americans really know how to like support their attachments that they have. So like we had great like quarters, we had great rations. Certainly never something I'll ever complain about. So
awesome. What other sort of postings have you had after that?
So in 2017, I then got promoted to major. And I was selected to be the executive assistant to the Commander 3rd Canadian Division, which at the time was now retired Lieutenant General Trevor Cadieux. So absolutely like humbling and probably like the best person I've ever worked with alongside. I would go to war with Trevor Cadieux tomorrow, like hand on heart. And so I did that for 2 years. Normally it's a 1 year gig, but he had asked if I would stay on for a second year. I'm like, absolutely. I just got to talk to my artillery boss, but as of right now, I'll say yes. So I've learned so much from Trevor Cadieux and I'm incredibly grateful to have him as an advisor, a friend. Humble experience. And I already knew this before, but he really drove it home. Like, he never introduced himself as like General Cadieux. It was just always like, hey, Trev Cadieux. And like, I put my pants on one leg at a time, just like everybody else does. And not everybody thinks like that. And sometimes there's a hierarchical than thou attitude for some people, but he was one of the most like down to earth, humble people I've ever had the privilege and honor to work for. So I'm grateful for that. And then in 2019, I got posted back to Shiloh to be a battery commander for headquarters and services battery. So in charge of about 158 soldiers, essentially what the infantry would call like a combat support perspective. We were also the lead mounting unit for Unifier Roto 9. So we deployed a large amount of the unit in support of that. So getting ready, you know, I didn't deploy. I was the only battery commander that stayed back with the acting CO. So I was the battery commander for headquarters and services battery. I was also the battery commander for another battery because their battery commander was deployed. It was very, very busy because Op Unifier was very like rank, like leadership heavy. So like, you might have all the leadership deployed, but then you have like 350 young guys back here, young guys and gals, and sometimes people get in trouble when they're bored. And so I had heard, I conducted 9 summary trials, which we refer to them, we now refer to them as summer hearings, but I conducted 9 summary trials in the span of 10 months. So that was busy because every summary trial is different, given the context or nature of the alleged offense. So I did that for 2 years. And then that brought me back. So June 21, I was then posted to Ottawa, to the Canadian Forces Support Group Ottawa-Gatineau, as the Deputy Operations Officer. And I still maintain contact with my boss at the time, Lieutenant Colonel Bedley, great guy. And we had this saying, we made it up, that CFSG ops dealt with everything from the geese to the queen and everything in between. And we would get all the complaints about the geese, because currently campus is on the green belt, so it's a protected status, the animals on there. So there's probably like a couple thousand geese that call Carlin campus home. And I'd get complaints about like geese fighting each other on the Afghanistan Memorial Hall pond. And people would call me like, hey, I just want to tell you like the geese are fighting each other. And sometimes I would just have to like hang up the phone, because I'm like, I'm not sure what you want me to do about this, but like, I'm pretty sure geese have existed for thousands of years without human intervention and they're all right. And because the next step would be like me going out to try to like break up the geese, and I'm going to get a call about some blonde major out there attacking the geese like a broom or something. And
yeah, you can't harass the wildlife.
No, not at all. And I kind of became like an advocate for the geese, because people complain about them so much. Another big thing, you wouldn't think it was a big thing, but like Starbucks hadn't come back to Carlin campus. And people like refused to come back to work until Starbucks came back. And like Carlin campus, or like National Defense Headquarters, doesn't own the Starbucks franchise that's located there like Starbucks does. And they weren't going to come back until Carlin campus was operating at 65% or higher. And I understand it from like a financial gains perspective. But the, you know, work from home or work remotely mantra is highly encouraged in, you know, Ottawa and throughout the CAF at large. But I can certainly see it in Ottawa, because like we've established that you can do your job over 2 years without even having to be in the office. So, but probably twice a week I would get the old call or the email like, when is Starbucks coming back? Or like, the fact that the Starbucks is not come back is like directly affected the operational output of my unit. And you're like, oh my god. So that was interesting. And then I got asked probably like 3 months later if I would come back to Shiloh in 22 to take over as the officer commanding Charlie Company at the 3rd Canadian Division Training Center, Detachment Shiloh. So we're a lodger unit at CFB Shiloh. Our headquarters is located in Wainwright. So great working relationship with the base, with the headquarters. So we run all the courses from like this past summer, just because CFLRS had such a much backlog of courses, we actually had to run 2 Reg Force basic courses. Both of them are infantry, all infantry. And then we ran what's called a development phase 1 for infantry. So it was all like the basic infantry course, Reg Force. That was another challenge. We started with 46, we ended with 23. Yeah, we have some staff that trained, you know, students really hard, but they trained them within the left and right of arc that they were given for. And sometimes people are recruited into the infantry or into the combat arms that shouldn't be in there. I always talk to candidates and I was like, why did you want to be an infantry? And he's like, I wanted to be a pilot. I'm like, oh my God, we are very far away here from what your initial goal was. And there's sometimes like, and I understand the recruitments sometimes have to recruit so many personnel, like, or they have a quota that they have to meet every year. And but this generation going through training, I think it is a bit different now. You know, they kind of went through COVID the last 2 years. You know, a lot of them have been secluded at home. And I started to see it, like they had a really hard time with seeing past hardship that they were experiencing right now. Or like if a ruck was too hard, they're like, oh, I'm quitting. I don't want to do this anymore. So having a hard time seeing like, you know, everything has an end date, like everything has an end time. Like they hadn't developed that mental resiliency, and I understood because they were so like they're still young in their career. But you started to see like, you know, either people got medically injured off and then they would be shipped to Wainwright to start a new DP1, or people just voluntary release. And it was interesting to see, because like the course is 11 weeks long and we had 2 candidates put in for VR on week 10, and you're like, you're almost done with the course, and they're like, yep, I don't want to do this anymore. And you try to like provide some positive words of encouraging, like, hey, what you're experiencing on course right now is not what your everyday life is going to be like at the battalion. I can tell you that right now because I'm married to an infantier. But they're like, nope, I've had my mind made up. I've decided I don't want to do this. And you're like, okay. So, and like, we shouldn't want to keep people in the army and the infantry that absolutely don't want to be in there because maybe there's another avenue for them. Like maybe they'll do better in the reserves or maybe a different trade that's not as physically intensive. But I mean, like they join the infantry. Like you signed up for the infantry. It's if the infantry was easy, then everybody would be doing it. But it's not easy. It's designed to be like physically hard, like physically demanding. And so the ones that we graduated, the 23 that we graduated, I believe there's going to be like a lot of potential, like good infantiers in that group. Some of them might get to a battalion, like maybe they'll go to 3RCR and they're like, oh my God, this is not what I signed up for at all. And, but people make their own decisions. I think the CAF is a great opportunity, especially for a young guy that's like 19, 20 years old. And, I'm hoping that a lot of them stay in and, get to reap the benefits of it. And then, so I'm actually going to transition out of this job in about June or July because I was offered to take over as the second in command at the 1st Regiment, Royal Canadian Horse Artillery. So not leaving Shiloh, just going across the street. So this, I believe that this would be like a great opportunity for me. So I'm really looking forward to it and see the challenges that can bring. So yeah.
I'm just going to go back to when you were talking about the younger generation now. I mean, I think, you know, there's this whole push to maybe not fail kids in school or not hand out number grades. And people joke about it, but the participation ribbons in sports. But in my opinion, that's a hindrance then for later on in life when you do meet a challenge, because then you're not set up to handle that properly. And I think maybe that's some of what's going on there.
Yeah. And I think, because there's definitely like more parameters in place. We can't train them as if like how you and I were trained when we went through basic. There's a process now, like if a candidate refuses to train, it's called a serious incident, and they get two serious incidents before they'll proceed to a progress review board. Like when I went through, like there was no refusal to train. You didn't even think about that. Like if you refuse to do your basic military swim test because you have a fear of drowning, like we didn't even think about that. You were like, Sergeant, I don't want to get in the pool. And they're like, shut up. And you got kicked in basically. So, you know, we had some issues with candidates who didn't want to get in the pool because they were afraid of drowning. Well, you don't know if you don't try, and you know, you might have a fear of getting shot at, but you don't know that until you get shot at. Like, so, I found almost like a real resistance. Like for some of them, they didn't want to push past their comfort zone, like into the unknown. Like, and I understand that doing things that you've never done before can be scary, but that's what the army is, because you've never done it before and every day is different and it's meant to be challenging. And if it wasn't, then everybody would join it. If you're not meant to be in the military, then you're not meant to be in the military. And that's not saying anything bad about people, but sometimes like people are just better suited in a physical trade, or maybe you're not suited in that trade, but you're suited in more of a support role. And that doesn't mean you provide any less value.
Yeah. And I mean, it's challenging for a reason, not just for the sake of being challenging. Like it's hard because the job is hard and you might be in a situation where you end up in the water and you need to know how to swim, or, you know, if you're rucking or, you know, on a patrol from point A to point B, well, you can't just quit in the middle. Like that's not an option if you're actually out on an operation or in combat, right? So it's, you know, there's very much a purpose behind it.
Absolutely.
And what are your thoughts on, I'd like to get your perspective, I guess, as a female member of the combat arms. So you hear of sort of the higher ups at some point saying like, oh, we need X percent of women in, you know, the combat arms or in this job or the infantry or whatever. And from my perspective, certain jobs like that I've done, like at my unit now, I'm the only female, and there was one before me, but she got out before I was there. And then there was another that went through selection, but wasn't picked up. And then other than that, no other females have applied. So it's, I think a certain point is that they just don't want to do the job. So I don't know about like, you know, that forcing them to go in that direction or trying to sort of force them to sign up for infantry, like at the recruiting center. I don't know that that's kind of the right thing to do.
Yeah. And I'd honestly wholeheartedly agree. I think if someone is going to be an infantry soldier or an infantry officer, as an example, it's because they want to be it. Like, I don't think at any point in time should we ever like try to force people into trade, because like if you try to force a soldier or an officer into a trade, like, and then they end up getting like medically hurt and then medically released, well, if they shouldn't have been in that trade to begin with, like maybe they weren't going to be like an outstanding or even a good infantry soldier, officer, or artillery officer, artillery soldier, but maybe they could have been a great military police. Maybe they could have been a great cook. Like maybe, you know, so I think we do ourselves a disservice when we try to force personnel into trade, because they're either not physically equipped for it, they're not mentally equipped for it. It's not what they signed up for. It's not what they want for their life or in terms of their career. But I think there's certainly, like, with the amount of trades that are available in the CAF, there's certainly something for everyone. But I certainly don't think, like, and I've heard the quota before, and I certainly don't think people should be forced into trades that they're not, they have absolutely no interest, right? Because they'll just, they might not even make it through basic, or they'll start their trades qualification. They're like, this is not what I signed up for. And then you could potentially lose a great person that could actually would have been better suited and could have been a great officer or soldier in another capacity.
I mean, it's not setting them up for success at all. If someone goes in and says, you know, I want to be a naval warfare officer, and they're like, oh, well, you know, how about the infantry? We need more women in the infantry. It's just, yeah, in my opinion, it's some of the people that make those statements aren't the ones that have done, you know, that have done the courses or the jobs that have so few women in them. So I think maybe to a certain point, they kind of don't understand that it's just a certain type of person is drawn to that. And if you're not drawn to that, then it shouldn't be forced.
No. And like when I, like they offered like the combat arms, but they also offered me MARS officer, and they're like, okay, so your first posting would be you'd be stationed in a submarine for 6 months off the coast of BC. And I was like, oh my god, like no, like absolutely not, like this, like what else do you have for me? And they're like, okay, so we have combat arms. I'm like, okay, just let me read a few descriptions here. And like if someone told me like you have to join as a MARS officer, I'd be like, forget it. Like I can swim, but I have a fear of drowning, and something about being in a submarine for 6 months. I'm like, nope, like this is not coming towards me whatsoever. And I was like, oh, please just offer me anything else, because the MARS officer is not going to cut it for me here. So,
oh my God. Yeah. I mean, I'm a diver and I would not want to be on a submarine. That's definitely a job that takes like a special kind of person to be on one of those. I mean, maybe if it was like one of the sort of fancy shiny new American submarines, maybe, but it's still just like, yeah, it's very claustrophobic and takes a certain kind of person.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I've seen your Instagram and weightlifting pictures and that sort of thing, so talk to me about the importance of fitness and the combat arms, and then sort of what your routine looks like to stay in shape.
Probably about six years ago, so probably about 2016, I really got into like fitness and nutrition. But that was a direct result. Like I competitive show jumped for horses. And in 2012, it was the first time I was riding a horse outside for that year. And we took a jump and they spooked. And when you're taking a jump on a horse, you're in a position called 2 points. So you alleviate your weight off their back. And so I flipped over their head and my foot got caught in the stirrup and I got dragged and stepped on. So I actually broke my back by fracturing the L1 of my spine. And so the spinal surgeon's like, you should never ride a horse like ever again in your life. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's going to be quite a shift for me. And so like, what do I do now? And I got in the army and I was like, okay, like I'm going to have to like kick up my fitness here. And then when it came down, like, hey, you should never ride horses again because your spine can't take another hit like that, I was like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to get into something. And then so I got into like weightlifting and like really started to like research and have a better understanding of what like the value of a calorie is and how it fuels your body. And I think like I think just working like every day, like work out 7 days a week, and it's just, for me, it's really fueled into like being like physically resilient, like fuels into being like mentally resilient. Like I honestly believe that the body is an amazing thing. Your body will do whatever you tell it to do. And the first thing that, you know, we try to really instill upon the candidates is that, like, you know, if you're having a hard ruck or a hard run, like your legs will take you wherever you want them to go. And it's only when you shut down, like mentally, that like, or your heart's like, this is not for me anymore, then that's when the body starts to follow suit. I think it's incredibly important, because especially when we are given the opportunity to deploy, those soldiers and officers that are more like physically fit do well, I think, or do better in terms of like hardship or environments that they're exposed into. I think for me, it really just became a part of my life, and then it became my lifestyle. Like, there's not really, you know, a day or two I don't go without training. And I think it's just, it's not for me. It's not for like stepping on stage or like bodybuilding or anything like that. It's just like every day working to be like stronger, so that, you know, if I do sustain another injury of that type, then I'll be able to like better recover from it. Because when I broke my back, you know, the spinal surgeon told me like, hey, you have to really like take it easy. Like, I wasn't allowed to carry greater than 2 pounds. I wasn't even allowed to walk the dog. So one of my girlfriends had to walk the dog for me at the time. And that just like really hit home for me. I was like, you know what? I can either make the best of this injury or I can make the worst. So I was on sedentary duties for 8 weeks. The regiment was deployed to Wainwright. So every day I just went to the gym, and I would just do like 15 minutes on the elliptical, no impact, no resistance, just like moving the legs and like moving my arms back and forth. And then I would go and sit in the sauna for 20 minutes, because I found the sauna was the only thing that would like just calm like my pain receptors from firing all the time around my spine. And then I did that for 8 weeks. And when I went, like, obviously I was seeing the spinal surgeon about every week as we went through there. And at like the 8 week period, he's like, you're probably like one of the people that had like the best recovery I'd ever seen. And it's because I did an active recovery. And like, I think if I like just sat at home and did absolutely nothing for 8 weeks and just laid on the couch, then I don't think like, I think my mental health would have really taken a dip. And then physically, like, where would I have been at if I just did nothing in terms of like trying to help the body recover? So that was April 2012. And then had, I think, like what was called like really good, like active recovery. And then I ran the Marine Corps marathon in October 2012. So that was a great marathon. And it was going into like a hurricane in Washington. So it was like the wind was really high. There was a lot of hills. We don't have any hills here in Shiloh. So like you have all these factors working against you. And but I think like if I hadn't worked towards like trying to like make the best of the injury, then I probably wouldn't have been able to do the marathon with the one brigade. And so I think like for me, like physical fitness, and training like every day and like training hard is just, I think it's part of like being a good soldier, like being a good member in the CAF. When I did my force test this year, the PSP told me that they had seen like an insurmountable amount of failures since they started the force testing back up since last September 21. And I mean, like that is our basic gateway for training, like our basic gateway for deployment and for the first on units combat force tests. And I was like, we should be able to do this every day if we had to. And just like we used to do the BFT, like the 13 kilometer rucksack march. And I remember people just like shutting down like during like mid-March. And for combat arms, especially, like, hey, you should be able to throw your rucksack on anytime. It's like, you're carrying this and you're carrying this, and we're going for this undisclosed period of time, and we're going for this undisclosed period of distance. And you're like, okay, like, and then you just kind of like put your head down and go, or you talk to your buddy that's like marching beside you. So I think like, especially in the combat arms, like you want to make a good career out of it and like be able to recover and to be successful, then like being physically fit comes around with it. So.
Yeah, that's actually very discouraging to hear people failing the force test, because that's not a difficult test. And, you know, I used to run that test at the reserve unit in Toronto when I worked there. And like people would come through, and some people were people that hadn't even really worked out before. And it's like they could pass it. The standards aren't crazy on that. Like it's a very sort of forgiving test, I'll say. So the fact that people are, you know, in the military and serving and not able to do that is a little bit alarming. Yeah. So for your program that you follow, like, do you make up your own program, or do you like hire a coach?
So I did work with a coach for 5 years, and he was absolutely great and outstanding. And then he really taught me like how to group certain muscle movements together, how to, like, you know, calories on like a high day of training vice calories on like a lower day, like the importance of like rest. You don't have to like hammer cardio all the time, but the importance of being like a maintenance phase and then like a growth phase and then a cut phase, so that you really understand like the structure. And like, I really got to like learn how like things tie into your body and how, you know, how crucial like sleep is for recovery. How like for females, like our hormones are essentially like out of whack 3 out of the 4 weeks of a month. So like learning to be able to like balancing your hormones, having like good blood work and like getting like a blood panel done like maybe once a year just to see like everything's good, and really like understanding like the value and like of a calorie and what it means, and but not going like too crazy on the other side. Like I'd worked with like some coaches in the East Coast, and when I started working with the coach that I was just with for 5 years, he's like, you know, your hormones are fried right now, because he was just like hammering like cardio all the time, and like your body just like will eventually stop responding because you're just putting too much stress upon it. And I remember for like the first 8 weeks I worked with him, he's like, no cardio at all. And I'd always been taught to be like, oh, I need to do so much cardio, and then your whole body composition will just change once you like actually fuel it right and then train it right. So that was a big like learning experience for me, and like just being able to like put your like trust and confidence in someone else in order to enable you to be a better version of yourself. I thought that was very beneficial. So and I found it like transferred into other things, like being stronger as a result of like going to the gym and getting stronger, like transferred into like slow pitch, because like I was throwing the ball harder, like I was hitting balls out of the park, like both bigger ball which the guys hit and smaller balls which females hit. And you just learn by like putting on like that good lean muscle mass, like it transfers to like your power ratio. Like rucking was easier. I was sleeping better. Like don't get me wrong, like especially the guy that I live with, like he loves his treats and that, so like I'm not so crazy as that, like I won't have like a, you know, a date night on a Saturday night or whatever, but I do try to like really watch what I eat. And but I understand that like not everyone's perfect too, so you have to like kind of like strike that balance between like always being like so hard on yourself to being like, hey, it's okay to like deviate from your meal plan every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, and I used to do the fitness competitions, you know, a little over 10 years ago, bikini competitions. That's how I know Melissa, the other Melissa. And I mean, at that time though, it was such an unhealthy relationship with food, because depending on your coach, and most of the time it was just, you know, chicken and broccoli kind of diet. And, you know, if you eat a cookie, then you just feel like you're a complete failure and you've just ruined your whole diet. And at the same time, it's like you're working out every day and eating healthy, but I didn't feel strong. Like I looked lean and muscular, but in terms of performance, like I was probably close to my weakest at that point. And it took a lot of years. I mean, I ate healthy for quite a while, but now I'm finally at that point where just, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was like, okay, it's time to get back into sort of stepping it up. And I think I'm ready to like have someone help me with my nutrition, but not get too crazy with it, because I don't want to go back to that place where I was before, where it was just like, you can't even be in a social setting that has little treats around.
Yeah. And like, well, we know what it's like going through silly season, right? Like, someone brings something into the office every day, or there's like a potluck on this day, or like when your spouse is also military, then it's like his company party is this day, and then it's like the regimental dinner and dance. And I was like, I feel like once we hit December and get into silly season, it's all about like parties and food and like drinks. And like, and I understand, like, you know, drinking used to be like a big culture as part of the calf, but it's I don't feel like it's like that anymore, because like I don't drink, and that's just because like I, now that I understand the value of a calorie, like I would just rather eat a burger or a piece of cheesecake. And then like, I don't want to be hungover, so I'd rather go to the gym in the morning than that. But like, and I understand it used to be like big thing, part of mess culture, but people's lives change, people's priorities change. And if I would never question anyone if I'm like, hey, do you want something to drink? And they're like, no, I'll just have a Diet Coke. I'm like, roger that. There you go. And that's where it sticks with me. But I understand there is still a bit of a mentality like, oh, come and have a beer. And you're like, no, I don't drink. I'll just have a Diet Pepsi or whatever. Like, and it's almost like sometimes a foreign concept to people. And, but I think like it's part of like a new culture. And I think it's actually good to shift in a different direction sometimes, because there's absolutely nothing wrong with like not drinking, and to have like, you know, a culture that was previously kind of fostered around it is, I think we've moved past that now. So
yeah, I've definitely seen a shift as well. I mean, like years ago, it just used to be, especially this time of year, I mean, you know, going into work and people would be like drinking at like 10 or 12 o'clock around the Christmas season and just going really hard. But I think, you know, and now you see people like not really staying as late and drinking as much for the sort of Christmas events. So there has been a shift. And then going back, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about leadership, what you were saying about Trevor Cadieu being very like relaxed. And when I was in Toronto, I was one of the only people at the unit with 404s for whatever reason. And so I would always be driving VIPs when they had people come through Toronto. So I drove actually the former commander of the Navy, Admiral Ron Lloyd, a bunch of times. And he was the most down-to-earth, friendly person ever to drive around. And it's funny because I find that sometimes like the people in the middle are not like that at all. They're almost like they think that they're so important, but then the people at the very top are just super relaxed. He's like, no, don't even like, don't get out of the car and open the door for me. Like, I'm good. You know, so what qualities have you seen or do you think sort of make the best leaders?
I think realizing that like one of the biggest things is that like, you know, at one point in time, like everyone is new in the military, everybody's going to make mistakes. The biggest thing is that like, if you make a mistake, then you own up and take responsibility for it. I think having an understanding that like everyone is person, everyone is human, everyone goes through different things. Sometimes people are having challenges in their life and maybe that affects their performance at work. And sometimes it's notable. You're like, hey, what's going on with Bombardier Bloggins? Because that's not normally like them. And I'll put it like this, like I lost my voice at Slow Pitch Nationals because I'm an outfielder and just from like yelling and, you know, encouraging all week. And I'd be in the batter's box and I'd be like, yeah, like, let's go, Viv. And like my voice just totally cracks and everyone's like, oh, Melissa, you need to learn how to yell. And I'm like, no, I don't. Like, I have a sergeant major for that. And if like the major's yelling, then something's gone wrong. Something's gone really wrong. Like, I don't need to yell. And I think sometimes like, and I was never a yeller because that's just not part of me. But I can be absolutely very direct, especially if I have to like, you know, I'm conducting a summary hearing or administering like some sort of remedial measures or an adverse PR, et cetera. You know, I can be very direct. And my style of leadership is I not like, because you know how sometimes people are like, people get yelled at and that's all they take away is getting yelled at. But I think sometimes people resonate with better or they learn from like, I don't want to disappoint that person. And I think it takes away, and I'll go back to Trevor Cadieu. I'm like, I never, when you plan a division commander's life for 2 years, like every day from like, you know, meeting at this time, you know, eat lunch at this time, drive down to this area, like stay here for 30 minutes. You have to like really resonate with the fact that they're human as well. And that was always, I never wanted to disappoint the boss. Like that was always in the back of my mind. Cause you knew like something went wrong if like the boss was disappointed and, cause he doesn't, you know, they don't need to yell. And I don't think like any leader really needs to yell. Like maybe that's at like the senior NCO, like junior NCO level. And that's from like a corrective measure. But like, I think people respond better to different styles of leadership. And it's not always about like, you know, yelling at someone with like the five finger point towards them. So I think adapting your own, like sometimes you have to adapt your leadership style. Like I was a battery commander for 158 soldiers. Like being a battery commander is different than for first line operational unit is different than being an officer commanding at a training center. So I don't get to interact with troops as much as I'd like to and like what I got to be as a BC. And I always kind of like joke to like the students or the candidates at the training center, you know, you don't want to see me unless it's on graduation day and you're getting like the top candidate or you're getting your badge into your regiment. And I always go to like, you certainly don't want to see the sergeant major because then something's gone really wrong there. So sometimes you just have to like change the mentality and the type of leadership depending upon the environment that you're deployed in or employed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think especially with the yelling to a certain point, like people just zone out and like just tune it out. It's just that white noise. And like you said, they don't take anything away from that. So it's not really, I mean, an effective leadership style, unless it's something, you know, for corrective measures, or if it's a sort of a safety, something that's like urgent where you need to yell at someone. And so what are your goals for the future?
So my husband just got promoted to sergeant in June. So right now I'm kind of at a part where like, I want to like, moved around quite a bit, like 7-8 moves in 15 years. And I would just like to have a little bit of continuity in my life. And both my CO at the 3-City TC and the CO of the Guns understand this. And so we'd like to stay in Shiloh for about 4 to 5 years. I really want to put Kyle's career first. And they say, like, as a service spouse, like, you know, normally it's the senior and it's the NCO that follows a major. Where is that written or where is that quantified? Like, my I used to be about, like, you know, I'm going to be a general officer, like, I'm going to shoot for the top. But as I went throughout my career this far, like, my priorities have changed. And, like, number one is always going to be my marriage. Number two is going to be Kyle's career. And then number three is job satisfaction for me. And that's not going to change in that order. So if we're able to stay here for about 5 years, I think that would allow Kyle to work through the rank of sergeant, maybe start the rank of warrant, and just give us some, like, continuity for our lives. And I think there's more to be said for being, like, happy with your life and what you're doing in terms of your job, vice, like, always trying to get, like, the next tech in the box. So absolutely love being back in Shiloh. And we bought our first house here. And after moving away from Ottawa, like, it was a pretty hectic 10 months. I was commuting over an hour every day, but Kyle was commuting over 3 hours every day. And I was like, nothing in the world is worth that. Like, you live with your spouse, but you don't live with your spouse because you hardly ever get to see them. And so now we're at a point now, like, say for Kyle, like, if he's done work at 4 and he get, I'll see you at 4:01, because he doesn't have to commute 3 hours anymore. So you actually, we're just really enjoying, like, our quality of life right now. And absolutely love being back in Shiloh. And the fact that I'm posted back to the Guns next summer, I'm really looking forward to, like, being back with everyone. So that's kind of, like, the next band for me. And so do this job for 1 year. So I'll move across the street in about the July timeframe, 23, and then hopefully get to be, like, the 2IC of the regiment for about 3 years. That would give us about the 4 year mark. And then maybe I'll transfer to something, like, on the base side after that. And then from there, like, the CEO of the Guns understands that, like, Kyle's a Patricia, and he knows what my priorities are. So we're either going to stay in Shiloh or we're posted to Edmonton, because it doesn't make sense for, I'm never going back to Ottawa. Like, I've made that quite clear, like, I'd never go back to Ottawa. And there's no advantageous employment in my mind for Kyle. I think, obviously I'm biased, but I think Kyle's an outstanding soldier, and he belongs in a battalion where he can mentor and develop soldiers, and that's really where he shines. And so if it's not here in Shiloh, then it's in Edmonton. So maybe in Edmonton, maybe in, like, 4 or 5 years from now, but we're looking forward to just being happy and being in one place for about 4 years, hopefully.
Yeah, it seems like I guess with the Navy, it's sort of a little bit easier where you're sort of on the East Coast, the West Coast, or in the middle at a certain point in your career, but there just seems to be not as much moving around as there is in the Army. So I feel like that's a lot of moves within a short period of time for you.
So I did, like, 2 years at the artillery school in Gagetown, and then I did 3 years in Shiloh, and then I did 2 years in Kingston, and then I did 3 years in Edmonton, and then I did 2 years in Shiloh, and then I did 10 months in Ottawa, and now I'm back in Shiloh. So I'm just happy to be back here. And my sister's in Ottawa, and when I told her we were getting posted back to Shiloh, she's like, why? Why would you want to go back there? Like, she's a corporate lawyer who's been in Ottawa her entire professional career. And she's like, but it's Ottawa. There's so much to do here. I'm like, no, this is, like, I'm like, Kyle needs to get back to a frontline unit, back to a battalion. And I'm like, and I absolutely love Shiloh, so it works out best for us. And when the career manager asked me, like, would you go back to Shiloh? I was like, yes. And he's like, did you want to talk to Kyle about it first? I'm like, no, he will say yes right away. I'm like, just cut the post message and we'll be on our way out the door. So didn't even, like, finish really unpack the essentials in that in the house in Ottawa. And then we, like, couldn't wait to, like, get back. And then we had to move. Our pack and load was during that, like, significant windstorm that Ottawa occurred. So they were, like, packing our house in the dark. And I was like, I have no idea where anything is going to, like, end up. And we couldn't even get, like, water or gas. Nothing was open. It was like a zombie land in Ottawa. So we were commuting, like, about an hour down south to Smith Falls. That's where we were staying during the pack load. And we would just go for a drive down to Smith Falls to get coffee at Tim's. And so, yeah, it was quite an interesting move back. But then we just came out here and bought a house in Spruce Woods. It's just about, like, 2 kilometers from the base. So you're close enough to the base, but you're not on the base. And we're on about 2.2 acres of land. So we're just on our own. It's just nice and quiet. And it's just us and the giant dog. So we're just happy to be back here and hopefully have some continuity in our lives for a little bit.
Yeah, so the dog's got lots of room to run around now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's quite the character, so.
And so what about other goals outside of the military? Do you have any further education that you'd like to do or any sort of athletic goals or anything like that?
I'd always like, and I'm glad you brought up the like bodybuilding that, and I'd always like thought like I would step on stage in like the physique category. I couldn't do figure because like I'm 5'10 as it is, like Icky Bob doesn't wear 5-inch heels on a good day. So I would wipe out on stage like 100%. So like I always thought like I was like maybe I'd step on stage in like the physique category, but I just don't know if I'm at that point in my life right now where I want to. Like I just want to be happy from like a physical fitness perspective and like how I feel about myself. I think I need to like come to a better spot with that first before thinking about standing on stage. And I can absolutely understand that you can empathize with that. And so I don't really have any other plans for like education right now. Being like the second in command, I'll have to learn a lot more about like non-public funds and public funds. So, cause I'll mostly be handling like all the money and then career management and planning for the junior officers. So something I haven't done before, but I have done like career planning as a battery commander, but this is just at the higher level for the unit level. So I'm really excited to do that. We hope to travel. Kyle's getting deployed to the UK in the new year. So we would like to do some travel to like Scotland and Ireland and just really enjoy like being married and being in one spot for one period of time.
And then so my final question that I always ask everyone is, what advice would you give to women wanting to join the military and specifically the combat arms?
I would say if you want to join the military, then do your research. The Canadian Armed Forces offers, I think it's a couple hundred different trades and occupations for you to select. And then if there is one that you really want to be a part of, and if, you know, you're told by the recruiter that it's closed at this time and, you know, it might open up in a year, then maybe that's not a bad thing, because maybe you don't want to be forced to do a trade that's maybe not, you know, it's not what you wanted at the end of the day. And there's something to be said for job satisfaction once you actually get into your trade and get trades qualified. So I would just recommend, like, sometimes that opportunity might take a little time to present itself, but things like that are worth waiting for. And if specifically if you, for females looking to join the combat arms, it's definitely going to be challenging. It's going to be challenging from a physical fitness perspective, and it's going to be challenging from a mental resiliency perspective. But if you can think of it as like, you know, you won't be the first person breaking ground. So like, and what I mean by that is there's been other females that have gone through the training system that are experiencing like the same hardships that you're going to experience. So just know that there's others that have come and gone before you. And if they can make it through, then you can make it through. You're just like, your heart has to be into it. And a lot of it is just a mental, especially during your trades training, because it's going to be hard, and a lot of it is just if you can make it through mentally, then your body will absolutely make it through physically. And if you can take away from that, I think you'll do just all right there.
Thank you so much for the interview today. We got over our technical hurdles at the beginning, but then it went smooth from there, so thank you so much.
But thanks very much, Kate. I really appreciate it, and I really enjoyed doing this.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to help support this podcast, please subscribe and leave a rating and review on your Apple Podcast app.